No, there is really more good news than bad news. And actually, what this title is hiding is that the talk will consist of two parts. The first one basically is a very short synoptical introduction or summary to what I call the asymptotic safety program, as opposed to general applications of renormalization group ideas to gravity. And this is intended to be the answer or a contribution to the answer of this question the organizers are posing this morning, namely, what are the fundamental degrees of freedom? So in this first in this I'm sorry, in this first part of the talk, I will review what are in principle the steps you should take in order to find out what are the fundamental degrees of freedom. And then in the second part of the talk, I will mostly concentrate on background independence and on the question whether or not background independence can coexist with asymptotic safety. And for that purpose, I will review some aspects. Most of you know very well background independence equivalence with split symmetry, the bimetric character of the effective average action. And in that context, I will then in part B show you some very recent results obtained with Danielle Becker. So to start the part of definition, so to speak, let me repeat that what we call the asymptotic safety program, it's a program at whose end would be a well-defined construction of a functional integral like maybe I. The pointer doesn't. Can you see it? Maybe I use another one. Okay, at the second, the main point is to give a meaning to such formal expressions, and this will involve finding out what can this S be. So in particular, we will compute what S is given a measure. So this is the goal, and the goal is not to do phenomenology or something like that right away, or to look for interpretations of the objects involved. So the successful end of this program is still many years ahead of us, but if it should ever happen, then one would have such an integral, could use it to analyze observables, compute whatever you like. So at a puristic level, that would be the strategy. So let's just focus on how to give a meaning to this object, very much like in the lattice attempts. Now, here is the to-do list. What should you do in order to arrive at such a path integral? Point number one, you pick a manifold, a topological or let's say smooth manifold. Then you pick a set of carrier fields, not to be confused with what people often call degrees of freedom. It's just fields that carry them, something like a metric field bind spin connection, and so on. Then you pick a symmetry group or a gauge group, something like diffeomorphisms times local O4, foliation preserving ones, and so on. Now, having this data, you construct what one could call a total set of fields, denoted psi here, which consists of those fields you picked and corresponding background fields, and also Fadeev-Popov ghosts if there is a gauge group involved, a non-trivial gauge group. So this is at your disposal then. Then again, you have to take a decision. You pick a space of fields, meaning that this space F is formally maps from psi to M, or more precisely, sections through bundles, but let's not be too precise. But then you also have to be very careful about specifying certain further ingredients, namely carefully specifying boundary conditions, for instance, or the degree of regularity and so on. And in particular, at this point, you put in information about states and things like that. Then next step, you pick a space of action functionals, which is basically a set of all maps from F into the reals invariant under the group of gauge or symmetry transformations, plus a certain number of further qualifications on which you must make up your mind. For instance, a certain degree of non-locality you could allow, worse non-local terms you could forbid and so on, or you could insist on a certain degree of differentiability, others you might forbid and so on. So make a well-defined specification here. Then next step, pick a coarse-graining scheme on theory space. So associate to every functional a transformed functional, which you call the infinitesimally transformed one under a infinitesimal RG step. Now, mathematically speaking, what this defines for you is a vector field on theory space, namely this change beta of A you interpret as living in the tangent space to the theory space. So up to here, what you have at your disposal is what mathematicians call a flow, namely the pair of a manifold with a vector field. Then comes a concrete duty, namely then you can compute the integral curves called RG trajectories for this flow. You have a flow equation, something like this, and you solve for such trajectories. And for instance, this vector field beta for our example of the effective average action, the vector field on the right-hand side of the flow equation has this well-known form. So then let's assume you have done that and you know all these beta functions in somewhat concrete terms. Then you search for fixed points, zeros of this infinite component vector fields. Then you can analyze them. First of all, you can do a simple analysis, namely the linear problem of looking for scaling fields and critical exponents near any given or any A star present. Then you do the more difficult exercise of finding the ultraviolet critical hypersurface belonging to that fixed point. That's a nonlinear problem. You look for all points pulled into A star under the inverse flow. So this is all pretty innocent. And now comes the crucial question, namely, given all these definitions you made, the crucial question is, can you find in that space T infinitely long RG trajectories, infinitely long meaning in particular that they have well-defined limits k going to infinity and k going to zero? It's by no means clear that this is possible. You could over-qualify or impose too many requirements on your spaces, then you will find nothing. If you are too vague and allow too much, you might maybe find too many fixed points more than you like, or you might also, for instance, that's the typical problem, you might find that the space simply is not big enough in the sense that RG trajectories terminate at the boundary simply because there are no the flow wants to generate terms that you did not into account and so on. There are all sorts of difficulties in finding these infinitely extended trajectories, but clearly those are the objects that sort of contain the information of a quantum field theory because those amount to integrating out all modes between momentum zero and infinity. So here asymptotic safety comes into play. Namely, asymptotic safety is a way of making sure there is a well-behaved limit k going to infinity. Namely, if you find a fixed point and you arrange your trajectory to run into that fixed point for k going to infinity, or vice versa, it emanates from it under the forward flow, then you are sure, at least sure, that in the ultraviolet that this limit is well behaved. Okay, so let's assume there is such a fixed point. You can do this construction, then also assume the infrared is fine. Then you have a family of trajectories that is asymptotically safe and defines potentially a quantum field theory. Now, or maybe you found nothing that is that works. Then comes going through loops. You use now a different fixed point if there is more than one, or you vary all the items you randomly picked or by some educated guess you picked before, and you look what happens then. And in this way, in principle, you would end up in the end at an understanding of what are possible universality classes. Of course, this is extremely ambitious, and of course we are miles away from having any concrete understanding of what this list is likely to be. But even if you are arriving here at some point, we still have no answer to the question the organizers ask us, namely, what are the fundamental degrees of freedom? Now, what is the meaning of this question? The meaning becomes clear only after a not necessarily compulsory step. You could be happy with having the running effective average action if it generates all endpoint functions for you. You could be happy with defining a quantum theory without a path integral. But now we might ask, is there a path integral behind that infinitely long trajectory we found in that way? So let's now continue with this last point, namely the so-called reconstruction problem. For that purpose, pick any convenient ultraviolet regularization of this a priori formal path integral. You don't know what S is, that's generic, and you fix some measure, regularize it, and cut it off at some ultraviolet scale lambda. Then at that level of the regularized, in the ultraviolet, regularized functional integral, you have to solve the inverse problem of given gamma k, find out what is the measure, what is the bare action, which by the usual construction, the usual way from the functional integral to the effective action, reproduces what you found before by solving the flow equation. So stated differently, the pair of the trajectory and the ultraviolet regularization scheme, this pair together implies a prescription then. That's what we showed with Elisa Manrique a while ago, implies a prescription for taking this ultraviolet cutoff to infinity, namely the k equals lambda going to infinity limit of the average action of the solution you found, plus a computable correction terms depending on the ultraviolet regulator, gives you the bare action for a specified definition of the measure. So with this extra input of the ultraviolet scheme and the measure, the regularized measure, here you arrive at the bare action. Now this bare action, once you have it, you will not like it most probably because it looks complicated and maybe it's not very inspiring. So now you have this complicated object, and to answer in a conventional sense of symplectic mechanics, what are the underlying degrees of freedom? You would like to reinterpret this object in Hamiltonian terms. This is far from, probably far from unique. It will involve rewriting and redefining fields in order to make the action maybe more local than it is a priori. And then you arrive at a path integral of Hamiltonian form ultimately, and you can read off, so to speak, what is the, in quotes and quotes, classical action that you implicitly quantized in solving the flow equation.
When you wrote the flow equation, you used a regulator RK, the particular one you wrote.
Yes.
Doesn't that object already select this of freedom? Isn't it supposed to decimate something?
No, not in that sense. Here, of course, this correction term depends on that RK, but degrees of freedom, this is a very dangerous word, and I realize that this meeting people are using the word degree of freedom in very diverse contexts and are mutually confusing themselves sometimes. What I call degree of freedom is what I read off at the very end here. That I call degree of freedom. And your question just referred to the definition of degree of freedom as field mode that is suppressed. And in that sense, of course, it suppresses. But when I have the infinitely long trajectory, the suppression is switched off, basically, when I go down. So, I mean, with the other definition, you are right, and you see how dangerous this is. Now, I mean, this is basically all very well known. I just would like to make one remark here, namely, when you do this reinterpretation of the a priori, maybe very non-local action, you might get something which does not look like pure gravity, and it is very likely that after this rewriting here, you will find something that you would prefer to interpret as matter. So you should be prepared here to find something that looks like the gravity we are used to, plus matter perhaps. This cannot be excluded, and since this is not explored yet at all, I'm very much intrigued about this possibility. Because the simple message is, given a field, call it scalar phi, as long as you don't know what is the action, you know nothing about degrees of freedom. And the same, of course, applies here.
Can you comment on this piece dependence on lambda? So lambda here is the ultraviolet.
Yes.
You would have an Hamiltonian description that would change with lambda, or?
Yeah, the parameters will change with lambda. It is, but I mean, I can suppress. I would, for instance, in QED, I would discover the QED action, and then when I take the continuum limit, I would of course have to write E is E lambda, and the mass of the electron is M lambda.
But the number of fundamental freedom is not expected to change with lambda. It's just the
right.
In practice, S lambda is going to have, if you could do it exactly, it's going to have infinitely many operators in it of higher degrees. The asymptotic safety.
Yes.
Not for QED.
Yes.
I don't see how you could start.
No, I'm not talking about any practical calculations for the time being. As I said, there is no concrete results on that, but conceptually it is clear. Talking, if you want to, here we are doing the inverse problem of finding the bare action, and having the bare action, the Legendre transform would be the Hamiltonian description, and that is what we would like to find out after convenient field redefinition. So this is sort of quite obvious, and how to do it is infinitely hard, I agree. Okay, now this business of changing the data, of course there is not much experience yet. We know from some first studies in conformally reduced gravity that topology matters, S4 and R4. We can distinguish at the level of beta functions we also studied adding or considering boundaries. We changed the definition of the field space, and that is really crucial, for instance, for this conformally reduced system between finite and infinite number of degrees of, between a finite and an infinite dimensional SUV, you can switch back and forward and backward by changing boundary conditions for the conformal factor. So this functional analysis details are really important. You can, that we studied in some detail, you can change different variables, you can change the gauge group to foliation preserving, to volume preserving. Or you, that was a very early investigation, you can study what happens if you allow for a different degree of non-locality. Long ago, we studied this F of four volume, F of Euclidean four volume, infinite dimensional truncation. And that is really very different, having it or not having it, because in this framework, you can easily continue your flows to k equals zero. We find an infrared fixed point, and everything is very different, and so that we can skip. And now we come to the second part. That was the program, and now let's embark on the more technical issues. Namely, the other big issue is background independence, and clearly this is so deeply rooted in quantum gravity or gravity in the classical sense. Also, this is really more fundamental and momentous than even the renormalizability issue, because renormalizability has to do with technical evaluations, and background independence is a very elementary notion which you can explain to a taxi driver, as I did yesterday. Now, this audience is basically divided into two groups, namely those who literally use no background, like in loop quantum gravity, CDT, spin forms, and this direction. There is no background, so there is nothing to worry about. Whereas in the effective action approaches, you use a background, you employ it, but you keep it arbitrarily. You never specify it explicitly, you keep it generic, and you enforce background independence by split symmetry. If you have a here written linear, but of course it's not linear in full generality, background split, you can add a little bit to the background, subtract it from the fluctuation, and you see that the dynamical field is invariant under this split symmetry transformation. So the task in this framework is not to quantize, as people did in the 70s, to quantize fields in a given background, but in a family of backgrounds with a given metric structure, G bar. And at the level of observables, this must respect split symmetry, this quantization procedure. Now, at the technical level, using the effective average action, you know that the cutoff term and also the gauge fixing term involves explicitly background split symmetry breaking terms. So it's a non-trivial task to restore split symmetry at the physical level, very much in analogy with quantum electrodynamics, in gauges, or in regularization schemes which don't respect gauge invariance. In that context, what you have to do is to fine-tune your bare photon mass so that the normalized one is zero. And in the same spirit, restoration of split symmetry is the same as here the selection of an appropriate subset of RG trajectories. So in this example, you see how important this selection is for... No. Okay. You see how important this is for picking the right for picking the right universality class. So the key question is, can this condition coexist with asymptotic safety? Now, you know the theory space in metric gravity is spent by functionals depending on GG bar, the background and the dynamical metric and the ghosts, or rewritten in the semicolon notation with H, the fluctuation, and G bar. So this G bar we call the extra G bar dependence because it is not there in a split symmetric situation. Now, starting from my first paper, what almost always was assumed was a gamma k, a truncation ansatz of this form, a gauge invariant piece, then a gauge fixing term, and a classical associated ghost term. This is called single metric, or we call single metric because it involves only, apart from this term, only one metric. And what we started with Elisa and Frank and Daniel Becker recently doing is now to generalize at least this first term, treating G and G bar on an analogous, almost analogous footing. You can write it that way, or an expanded form, H semicolon G bar, where the G bar dependence is expanded and P powers of the fluctuation we call the level P contribution. Concretely, what we did is a bimetric version of the Einstein-Hilbert truncation. We kept, this was in both of these papers, and now in particular the results I show are from this recent one. We kept two cosmological constants, namely for the background metric, here is G, and for the separately for the G bar. Or in expanded form, you have a level 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on, Newton constant, level 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on, cosmological constant. We evaluated it on this four-dimensional theory space, and you see split symmetry amounts to G background being infinite, and 1 over G is infinity, and lambda over G now is 0, and this is also 0.
Sorry, why don't you have also interactions between the...
Yeah, you can have all sorts. So this is just an assumption. This is just a... No, there's many, many more. So during the evolution, this is clearly violated. Now, the set of fixed points, for instance, the system nicely decomposes. Namely, you can first solve the two beta function equations for the dynamical ones separately without caring about the background ones. So in the dynamical sector, we find three fixed points. One of them, S for the coordinates, is pretty close to the single metric fixed point, extremely close, even S for the coordinates. But the critical exponents are very different, 3.6, 1.5, 4.3, 3.0, so that's very different. This is the phase portrait in the dynamical sector, looks like the usual, but there are differences. Now let's go to the six-dimensional space. You get six fixed points, one of them by various arguments you can identify with the generalization of the known one. And now let's study asymptotic safety with this fixed point. Now what we could show is that this has a four-dimensional SUV, so you would expect you have to fix by experiment four couplings, but in fact what you find, instead of a four-parameter family of admissible trajectories, you have precisely a two-parameter subfamily that restores split symmetry in the physical limit. So you have two remaining quantities you can fix freely. The other ones are fixed by the requirement of background independence. Now we studied in great technical detail the difference between single metric and bimetric, and we studied where bimetric needs really to be taken into account and where single metric is reliable. And I would just like to show you a few crucial plots. This, for instance, is the running of the dimensionless couplings of all four kinds of single metric, the dynamical one, blue, light blue is level zero, and this dashed is the background. You see the background always behaves in a very unintuitive way, and that's because it's absolutely unphysical. Now let's look, for instance, at this G dimension, full G. This is this curve here. What is new, and where really the old calculations all were misleading, is that in the at low scales below the Planck scale, the dynamical Newton constant increases towards the ultraviolet, and then only beyond the Planck scale it decreases. This is different from what we always had in the past. In the past, we always had gravitational anti-screening right at the Gaussian fixed point. Now this is not the case anymore. And Jan yesterday confirmed to me this behavior in the semi-classical regime is exactly what he finds in the simulations. So there is some truth in it. And now, there is some non-trivial coincidence. And the other thing I would like to show you here is these lines for the background. You see how nicely 1 over G background and lambda over G background goes to zero at K equals zero. This is the restoration of split symmetry. So this you can do for the other. This is the explanation. What is a miracle? I could tell you later. And now, maybe one last set of pictures. If you insert your dynamical trajectory into the flow equations of the background sector, you get a non-autonomous system of equations, and in that system you discover a running attractor, a running ultraviolet attractor. This object, this is the background dynamical trajectory, the dynamical, and this is the background coordinates of the attractor. And the statement is this two-parameter family of symmetry-restoring trajectories I mentioned is precisely the set of trajectories which for k going to zero in the infrared hits that running attractor. So there is a crossover, if you like, the acceptable quantum or the acceptable RG trajectories emanate from this double non-Gaussian fixed point in the ultraviolet and approach the running attractor in the infrared. So this is a typical picture. This inset here shows you by means of this red dot what is the time, the RG time. So the dot down here means it is k equals zero. At k equals zero, this phase portrait is the phase portrait in the background lambda G plane. So at k equals zero, here is an attractor. And what you see here, the two curves are two specific RG trajectories, namely the gray one is the RG trajectory that begins at the origin, and this, I cannot see colors, this this other one here, the other color emanating from this colored square here, this is the trajectory that emanates at k equals zero and the upward evolution from this attractor. So this is a little bit later in time. So you see the arrows, this pattern has moved, and here at that time the attractor is here and so on. So if you read it backwards, then this thing here you can regard as an example of a type 1a trajectory that restores split symmetry. The same, I mean, this explains how this shape comes about. This is by pulling by the attractor. That's not important. This is for the other trajectories. And to close with, now come the good news. There are various things that did not change or improved considerably. For instance, the running spectral dimension. In the single metric case, we had these three plateaus, three regimes of spectral dimension, 2, 4/3 in the semi-classical regime and 4 in the classical regime. And exactly the same we find again. This is for type 3a trajectories. You have the plateau corresponding to the fixed point, here the transition to the semi-classical plateau, and then the change to 4 in the infrared. This is for the separatrix, and this is for 1a. So no changes on that. Then something which really improves a lot by going bimetric, that is our old dream of formulating something like a C theorem in terms of the on-shell effective action. You know, the on-shell effective action has this representation by a path integral, so it just counts in a certain sense the modes. Now I'm saying modes in the sense of your question before. It counts the modes suppressed or unsuppressed at scale k. And this quantity, the running of this quantity, has certain features like a C function. Now, in gravity, you don't say on shell, you say I pick a self-consistent solution obeying the tadpole equation. But now, the intriguing thing at the bimetric level is that the tadpole equation contains the level 1 quantities, whereas the gamma at h equals 0 contains the couplings at level 0. So what determines this on-shell value now is a complicated interplay of dynamical and background quantities. And now you can insert this solution into that equation, for instance, for a force sphere. And what you find for the inverse C function is this in the bimetric case and this in the single metric case. So in the single metric case, this is far from monotonic, whereas in the bimetric case, what is plotted here is the derivative. It is beautifully decreasing function. The precise meaning of that is still under investigation, but it is at least in this case the equations work very hard to produce this behavior. So the conclusion is really very optimistic, namely, it is indeed possible to select background independent or split symmetric trajectories. This condition is restrictive, but not too restrictive. You want it to restrict ambiguities in the choice of parameters, and it does that, but something is left over. But what this inconvenient truth was alluding to is that we also see quite clearly, for instance, in the case of the critical exponents, that it will never be possible to get any numerically precise results without taking these background terms into account. Typically, the mistake you make by doing a single metric truncation is bigger than the scheme dependence in the single metric truncations. But, and that's again a very good news, I think, just even if these calculations are hard, I admit they are more work, but there is also an enhanced qualitative understanding by just thinking about what would happen at the two metric, at the biometric level. And to close with, I would like to present this argument. People were discussing at this meeting already repeatedly, namely, basically without any calculations, it's clear that the single metric F of R truncation is somehow overstretching the idea of a single metric a truncation. If you keep infinitely many monomials in one metric but not in the other, it leads to paradox questions. For instance, you can ask this function f, what is its domain? Well, it maps from somewhere into the reals, but this domain, is it all reals, the positive reals, negative reals, and so on? Of course, to solve a kind of Sturm-Liouville problem to compute the dimensionality of SUV, as Tim explained, this is absolutely crucial to know, but the paradox is you cannot make up your mind at a single metric level. Assume technically you did a computation on a round four sphere with metric G bar. Then if you interpret the single metric as the background, then you would say, of course, it is either positive if I take a sphere, or it is negative if I take a hyperbolic space. So it should, let's say for the sphere, I should use just R plus for the domain. But on the other hand, if I'm optimistic and I pretend that this argument here, this metric, is the dynamical metric, and that's the pretense behind the single metric approximation. If I'm optimistic, then I would say G is the dynamical metric, but the dynamical metric can have both a positive and a negative curvature, and it is certainly not X independent in general. So in that sense, I would say it must be positive and negative. And so whatever you do in the single metric context, it's half wrong, half right. But clearly, in a biometric context, you could have a curvature for the one and a curvature for the other, which is then just positive, all sorts of mixed terms. Or one could do, I mean, what one should do is to approximate somehow this object, but not in the strict way, but, okay, but more, for instance, in this hybrid way, as Frank and collaborators did recently.
So we have very little time. We have 10 minutes. So, Tim was first.
Martin, it's a short one, but I understand what you're saying here. However, there is a dilemma that you have to address, we will have to address at some point, even if you could do the calculation exactly in the biometric context, which is, should you be smoothly matching between manifolds of topology or not?
No, certainly not. I mean, that was basically refers to the very beginning of the talk, namely the sequence of choices. I think it should not match. It should never match, because you never encounter a problem where you need the function for two topologies at a time. You first fix the topology and then you do the path integral. So Frank's motivation is different with this hybrid. This is a helping by two different backgrounds the equations to mimic a H mu nu.
I think you can take that point of view, but I think you can also at the moment take the other point of view. I personally believe, actually, you should stick to one point, but I think at the moment it's a belief statement. You could find, for example, that if you did it exactly, that you don't have a single asymptotic state to this point, even the biometric truncation. And then it's a question, as you quite rightly said at the beginning, you have a set of choices. You may have a choice that if you could actually do the calculation exactly, you could now consider the possibility of smoothly deforming your manifold.
Yes.
I mean, in a sense, it's hard to make sense geometrically, but it is possible with through these equations and consider matching into other manifolds. It would give you further restrictions which may actually be useful.
Yes, but that should come out automatically with. Yes, that's basically what I think is the strategy behind Frank's using both, but I was I mean, the reason why I put this transparency is one has to emphasize that this has nothing to do with merging the data of different topologies into one function. This is not the goal, because it is never needed. It is rather the motivation is to find a shortcut for a more difficult calculation where h mu nu is expanded up to high orders. And,
wait, is your question really quick?
It's a remark which is really quick. I just again want to draw attention to two-dimensional quantum gravity, where the progress called Isola-Kawai, etc., is exactly a bimetric approach, where you have a background metric. All the strengths of this come from the requirement that the participants should be independent.
Yes.
Of the background.
Yes.
And it is very interesting there that progress was only made in smooth and significant way when you change to what you call the bimetric formulation.
Yes.
The original formulation was a single metric formulation.
Yes.
And you could never solve anything because the cutoff was depending on the single.
Yes.
Only when you distance it for the bimetric.
This is work in progress, and I hope in a few weeks. I agree 200%. That is again something where one can, just without doing any calculation, dispose of many misunderstandings. And
okay, so on that note, let's have a